This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I mean, who's not catching fish right now, huh? I mean, you can't really say that too often. And I know we've all had our ups and downs, but it's been pretty hot. All up and down the Texas coast, Louisiana, into Florida, where all our listeners are here on the Bite Me podcast. I am John Lopez. Captain Scott Knoll is across the way from me. And how about this? How about an old friend? Captain Nick Mosley joins us from his place down in Sargent, where I like to end up most days, more days than not. Captain Caleb is actually fishing right now, so we can't blame him for that. If you're going to come up with a good excuse, don't say something, you know, your aunt is sick or your grandma died for the seventh time. Might as well be honest. He's fishing right now. He's on them pretty good, and that's one of the places we're going to start. But Captain Scott, you know, some of the things that we're going to get into today are it figures to be spirited, if you will. And I like that. I like that because we like to you know, talk on all topics, some topics with which we agree, some topics with which we don't agree, but we have listeners of every ilk, and we're going to talk about big bait and big fish, which is an ongoing topic that people like to ask about. But then we're going to get into some of the stuff that that I think is going to be a fun discussion, that such as croaker soaking. You know, you guys know where Captain Scott and I stand on that. I'm pretty sure our buddy Captain Nick is mostly in that same boat, but he does have some experience, obviously, fishing with it. So I want to get that side of the story because we are an equal opportunity podcast. And if you haven't heard us before, you know what to do. Actually, you don't. You just subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. That would be iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else that has podcasts. The Bite Me podcast is on there. And the most important thing, because this is where we get kind of the juice for the podcast, and that's from you. Join us on the Bite Me group page on Facebook, and you can send us some topics, send us some questions, and we'll get to them. Now, we're also going to get to some really, really, I think a really interesting topic that, frankly, we haven't done enough of. We've talked about some of the storms that affected the fishery and obviously the freeze that affected the fishery. And I was actually out with Captain Nick on a very, very sad day when he was picking up, well, I wasn't out, but I touched base with him, picking up some fish that had died, monsters that had died. And I'm sure you saw that on his Facebook group page. But we're going to talk about some of the pressure from oyster boats and oystering on the reefs out there, which are essential, absolutely essential to the fishery. And we got sheep's head tactics. We've got all kinds of good topics for you, but let's dig right in. And I'm going to start with something that really just made me happy. And that's with Captain Nick. When I saw this, I believe it was in April, Nick. I mean, it just warmed my heart. I was a good friend of your dad, Joe Mike Mosley. And I know he won the Guides Cup there in the Matagorda area. And then lo and behold, in April, I saw a picture of you on that beautiful transport that you have, and raising a trophy on it. And I went, man, that is just the coolest thing. Like father, like son, just a cool story. We'll get into the meat of the topics here, but I wanted to brag on you a little bit, and I wanted you to be able to talk about what it meant. You posted it on Facebook, but the history of your father winning the Guides Cup, which is obviously some of the best, and then what happened with you, it was in April, I believe, right?
Yeah, it was in April.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so
well, it was actually supposed to be the October before, but COVID pushed the date of the tournament back. They had actually talked about canceling it and not having a 2020 Guides Cup. So, I don't know, it's a pretty special moment in my life. The Matagorda Bay chapter, which is out of El Campo, started this tournament. I want to say the first year, the first name on the trophy, I think, is in 1994. Mm-hmm. And it's Raymond Cox, who actually just passed away. So Really, really good company on the trophy. First of all, you have to be invited. They only allow 20 fishermen or 20 guides, and they don't basically auction us off at the benefit or banquet. And you have to fish a tournament with whoever bought your boat, and they get to bring two other people. So getting invited to fish the tournament is a big deal, because somebody either has to back away from it or get kicked out for some reason or another.
Yeah, we don't want to talk about that.
I was fortunate enough to get invited to fish it. And I want to say I fished it 2 years prior to when I finally actually won the tournament. And my dad won it back in 1998 and 2003. And I remember the first year he won it, how proud and excited he was. And I knew that when I got my captain's license, that was a big goal of mine. And I just still in disbelief, super excited about it, still happy. They actually had the tournament this October, like they normally do every October. So I only got to keep the trophy for 6 months, 7 months. And I had some bad luck. I should have trusted my customer, the guy that I had on the boat with me, to net a fish. And I decided to take it into my own hands. And
broke off.
I ended up winning big redfish, but in that tournament, but it's not the same.
That was really cool. And the reason it hit me is because I knew your dad and fished with him a lot. And Scott, you can talk to this, because just like me, and just like so many of our listeners, I mean, dad gets us into it. And, you know, my dad had five kids. Two of us had the sicko bug, you know, as Captain Mickey likes to call us, sickos. I was one of them. And I know you, with your dad, you know, to do something like that, I kind of put myself in that place. That's just beyond cool to, you know, for the guy that taught you everything, and gave you everything that you know, and you added to be able to win a Guides Cup, which is the elite of the elite.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He left some big shoes for me. And, he's just such a great man, great fisherman, great friend, really, really funny. And, I don't know. It's the way I carry myself in life, is just trying to keep him proud, do things that I know would make him proud, make him happy, and just do right by him and his last name he left me, you know,
Scott. So.
Yep. Dad took me all the time. You know, walking out on the North Jetty was one of my favorite things. Him and his buddy would take off on Saturday morning. Sometimes I'd get to go, you know, once I got old enough, we'd walk all the way out to the boat cut. I was a little bitty dude, man, jumping rock to rock.
Yep.
Remember that like it was yesterday.
You know, the funny thing, you know, my family didn't have a boat. I think I was the first one to ever get one back in the day. But my dad we'd fish every weekend possible. Now, I grew up in San Antonio. I've been in Houston for 30 something years, but I grew up in San Antonio, and we used to go to, he was a civil service worker. So we used to have access to the Naval Air Station down there, and they have a tremendous pier. I know you guys have seen it on your boat, but I was on the pier oftentimes. And we just sleep on towels, and we just go back to the car and sleep for a couple hours and come back and fish on that Naval Air Station and Oso Pier. And, you know, we'd sleep in the truck in his station wagon, and fighting off mosquitoes and everything, and some of the dumbest things you'd ever do. But that's why, you know, I got that sicko bug, and I just couldn't get enough. And look at where we are now. We're doing this podcast, you know, tens of thousands of people listen to us every week. It's just really cool. So I wanted to start there, but let's get into the topics and see if we can help some of these people, or at least answer some questions and get them to catch a bunch of fish. Now, the big bait, big fish discussion, was a question that, Sean, actually, I saw him out on the water a few weeks ago with Caleb, and he was catching some fish, but he posted it on our Facebook page, on the group page, that he got. Scott, I'm gonna start with you. You know, he was with, Caleb, I guess that same day that I saw him on the water. And he had a skitter walk, I believe. And Caleb said, you really probably want to put, you might want to put a bigger skitter walk on. Well, he posted a picture a week later. Lo and behold, I think it was his personal best trout or right at it. The whole big bait, big fish discussion, Scott, what is your advice on that? Because I have my thoughts, but I don't want to, you know, kind of bias your opinion here.
And I generally go smaller. Yeah, but there are times when you can go bigger and it pays off. The fall is a good time for that. The bait fish have matured. They're a little bigger than they normally are. With red, you know, most of my stuff's redfish, and the redfish have a smaller mouth. So I tend to go with a smaller bait so that they can get it in there a little better. If I was strictly trout fishing, looking for that big trout bite, yeah, I'd go with a really big topwater this time of year. And, you know, just slow roll it and walk it nice and steady and give them a good clean shot at it.
Now, I'm so glad you said that because, you know, oftentimes, Nick, when I'm, because I'm a veteran fisherman and I know a lot of fishing, but I'm not you guys. I always say that on this podcast, you know. But sometimes when I get an answer like that, I'm like, okay, I am right. You know, he kind of justifies, he justifies. And you know, Scott, that happens a lot. I'll tell you something of my thoughts and you go, yeah, that's right. I'm like, oh, good. Cause I've been doing it right all this time. But what he said there, Nick, that I thought was important is time of year. That's a big indicator for me, more of a trout guy myself. So that's a big indicator for me of when I want to go bigger bait. I'm looking at the bait. I'm looking at the area where I am. And the size of the bait that I see. So time of year has a lot to do with it. What are your thoughts on big bait, big fish?
Everything that we do has to do with conditions, right? It's whether the bait's big, the bait's small, it's windy, really early and calm in the morning, the, you know, low light, no light, really bright light, you know, high, you know, the sun's right above your head. Sometimes this time of year, you want to go with a smaller bait because those bigger baits will spook the fish. I know redfish especially get spooky. You know, you're fishing a school. You don't want to throw directly into the school. You'll end up busting them, spooking them. You got to throw just past them or just in front of them or, you know, hit them just right. So I would say if it's a little, my favorite all-time bait, I'll throw it all year long, is a super spook. Like for trout fishing, I love a super spook, which is about as big of a topwater as you're going to get. But the conditions have to support it. If it's really, really calm early in the morning and I feel like the fish are a little bit more spooky, if it's shallower water, I might go with a spook junior or a smaller top dog, you know, like the top pup or she dog or something like that. Or even, you know, going into the skitter walks. We'll throw skitter walks at trout too.
Right.
A lot of people think that that's more of just a redfish bait, but.
Well, he caught a trout on it.
Disagree. Yeah. Yeah.
Our listener, our friend.
I think I actually saw the post you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was based on advice from Caleb. And Scott, you know, for me, that goes for plastics too. You know, I everybody knows I throw the Deadly Dudley. I've been throwing Deadly Dudley for years. I mean, Nick has made fun of me on his boat because that's all I throw.
They've worked.
They worked. They have absolutely worked. But they have the 5-inch, you know, soft plastics and the 3-inch soft plastics. 9 times out of 10, I'm throwing the 3-inch, Scott. And I have thrown that 5-inch rat tail, the Blue Moon, the Salt and Pepper. And of course, the avocado with red speck, which I've talked about here. For me, if I'm even fishing off the bottom, you know, Scott, I'll put a bigger bait depending on what I see in the bait. Would that be something that you would do as well?
Yeah, start off bigger if you want to, but always be ready to go smaller. I see it in fly fishing all the time. You know, we're looking at the fish and we're throwing a fly in front of them. And they're just not reacting to it. They're turning off of it. It's just feel. You know, you get a feel for it. And then if you get refusals 2 or 3 or 4 times, and then go ahead and switch it up and go a little bit smaller and a little bit smaller. I mean, I've gone down to tiny, tiny, like bonefish.
You talked about it. You bite the end of it off sometimes.
Yeah. And that's all just something I've always done. When the bite gets tough, I go a little bit smaller and a little bit smaller. It seems to work most of the time. As far as like the calm, being spooky, what I've seen is when it's been really, really windy, like, you know, before a front, during a front, it's real windy. Then that you get that real calm day following the front. That's the day that they're the spookiest. The first day that it settles out and it's perfectly calm, you can't get close to a redfish. They'll spook off real quick. But if it's calm for 3 or 4 days, then they'll settle into that. I think it's just because they've had so much commotion around them, so much noise with all the wind waves that, you know, it's messed up their senses. And then all of a sudden it's real quiet.
Right.
I think about when you've been at a baseball game or football game, and then you go someplace quiet afterwards, you can just hear that ringing in your ears. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like maybe that's what the fish are dealing with. But switching sizes of baits is, that's all personal preference, but it never hurts to try it, you know, try something completely different if you're not doing any good.
Yeah, absolutely. And since I did mention Deadly Dudley, I probably want to mention this because a lot of our listeners might want to try it or get some more of the Bite Me 20 promo code, which you go to deadlydudley.com and just type in Bite Me 20, the number's 20, and you get 20% off right there. So I want to mention that. All right, let's get to Croaker. All right. Everybody loves you, Nick. Everybody loves you. Everybody loves you. But I wanted you on for this, and we were texting last week. I said, well, I'm not going to, like, you know, pussyfoot around this thing.
Yeah, no.
You're going to ambush him.
We're not going to pile
let's
on.
Let's talk about it.
We're not going to throw elbows. We're all that. But you know where Scott and I stand on throwing Croaker 100%. You have thrown them. Now, I want to be fair, and I know you're probably going to reiterate this too. You're an artificial guy, you know, you throw everything, but you are a working man, you know, and sometimes a year of the year, you're throwing Croaker. So this is the equal time, as much as it might pain me and Scott, this is the equal time segment of the Bite Me podcast. Yeah. What I'll leave it open-ended. You're throwing Croaker. Why?
So let me just start here. So it's kind of like
why the heck did I come on this podcast?
Now it's kind of like let's ban all the guns because they kill people type thing. The Croaker is not the problem. Like they're not. There's a certain group of fishermen that love to go down there and exploit them, I guess, from lack of a better term, mm-hmm. and have really given them a bad name. So I don't advertise Croaker trips. Like I don't try to market it. I don't intentionally mm-hmm. try to take people out there and do it. If I have people call me and they say they want to go throw them, absolutely, let's go. I ask mm-hmm. them their experience. It may not be the best option at the time because they're really not as easy to catch a fish on, at least not in our bay system, as some people might think that they are. Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard stories, you know, down closer to Rockport, Corpus, you know, you get on a little bit more aggressive bite throwing them. But, you know, we struggle sometimes throwing them in our bay. And I don't want to take somebody fishing and then be taking pictures of me with fish or me catching all the fish. Like, that's not fun for me, and that's not what I want to do. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's a hard bite to teach people. I don't know. Do I enjoy it? Yes, I do. Do I go out there and kill 23 to 30 inch trout every time I go? No, I do not. Mm-hmm. I don't encourage that. You know, I always encourage people to let fish go. I'm not about the big box of fish on the table. I don't know if you've noticed, like I actually kind of slowed way down on my social media posts. Like I hardly even really post much on Facebook anymore.
I like your videos. I like your Snapchat. You're one of the few guys I know that uses Snapchat a lot, which, you know, we're all about, you know, Instagram and Twitter, but Snapchat is good because you can post your videos. A lot of times you're out, you know, barreling across the water or you're showing a fish and releasing a fish. Let me ask you this before Scott weighs in, because as much as I'm not going to throw a croaker, it's just not me. But it is something that you just described, you know, that can be used, and it's more of a using the weapon the right way, to use your metaphor. You can use them, and I'm guessing the bigger point would be release the big fish. I mean, you're still got to use that mentality.
You just choose what you want to do with them, you know, and as a guide and somebody that's a teacher on the water, you know, we have an opportunity to educate people, you know, on rights and wrongs. If it's something you enjoy to do and you want to go out there, then go out there and do it, but be responsible and, you know, respect the resource mm-hmm. from, you know, I don't know.
Now,
I do think
go ahead.
That there are, I do think that everybody throwing croaker has a lot to do with why we're not catching them like we used to.
Sure.
And I do miss those days. So I do see a decline in that. And I would assume that it's got to be from all the shrimpers targeting croaker now. You know,
well, that you're absolutely right. It used to be kind of like a word of mouth thing. Hey, have you thrown a croaker? You know, back in the day. Now, Scott, my counterpoint to Nick, because I agree with everything he said in terms of if you're using them. My point on them would be, and you and I have talked about this, I just love catching croaker. And the fit, you know, the bait itself is kind of reducing. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, think how many big croaker we used to catch and how many big croaker have you caught recently.
Right.
It was a great kid fishery. You know, that's one of the ways that I got started. You're talking about your dad earlier. You know, we'd go out and get on the Texas City Dike and sit out there all night and catch croaker, just one after another. And they were big bull croaker. Yeah. Not little bitty tiny, you know, piggy perch size. These were, you know, good size croaker. I just kind of miss those days. And we'd also we'd catch them on spoons. Mm-hmm. You know, be out there fishing for trout and reds and get whacked. And you get a 2 or 3 pound croaker on, you know, it felt like a 5 pound redfish.
Oh, it's terrific. Hard. Yeah.
And so
one of the
I'd
best,
like
best bites
you're
going to get.
You know, I've always said, you know, I'd like to see them be game fish.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and it's not directly because, you know, the trout issue, because people know I don't fish for trout all that much. But it's more about the entire resource in general. The amount of pressure that's put on them by the shrimpers to catch enough croaker for the guys to use them all summer. I mean, I'll sit there and watch guys, two guys come in and buy 6 dozen, 10 dozen croaker. It's like, man, the limit's only 5 fish. How many croaker you need?
Exactly.
You know? Sometimes it takes a month.
Sometimes it takes a month. Yeah. I want to actually get to that because, again, you know, we're going to actually tell people about croaker fishing and something and get your expertise on that, Nick. But let me ask you both this. I'll start with Nick. Is there a compromise in this sense? We talked about this last week. The trout limit is going to be going down to 3. I think it's going to be going down to 3, probably. Uh-huh. The size limit is going to be limited as well. As much as that may not directly help the croaker population and where we're catching more croaker, not just using them as bait, more mature croaker, couldn't that, Nick, in a sense, actually help it somewhat because people are keeping less fish, hence throwing fewer croaker, hence there might be, you know, bigger croaker population?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I have mixed feelings about all of this. Like, I'd mm-hmm. like to see the data that supports them doing what they're doing. I have a really big fear on us having a maximum length trout. You know, what happens when somebody catches the new state record? And we're
well,
have,
Scott had a great point on that. Maybe issue a tag like you do redfish.
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, yeah. I think that they definitely need to go to some kind of tagging system because I would hate to see a same situation like the current state record. There's a lot of us more hardcore fishermen that are kind of like, yeah, you know, Jim Wallace, I think, still has a state record. Like,
yeah.
nobody
yeah.
saw that fish. It wasn't officially like, you know, and if I catch that big fish or say I throat hook one, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a 10 pounder, like, I would want to get that fish mounted and to have that option taken away from me. I don't know. I'm definitely down with the conservation. Like, we need to do something. Like, this is probably the worst year of trout fishing I've ever experienced in my life. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I've been fishing down in East Matagorda Bay since I was probably 7, 6 years old. So 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been through some freezes. They were a little lighter than this one. But I mean, I'm really hopeful that we're going to come back from it. And I think definitely, you know, if your limits change, I don't know that the people are going to not stay out there and keep catching fish, though. So I don't know.
Right. I think some
necessarily.
Will. Yeah. I think yeah. some would. Scott, what are your thoughts on, like, could that help the population, even marginally, would go a long way?
Yeah, it would help. But as what he's saying there, you know, they're talking about this being a 2-year temporary deal. Then you'll hear the other side of that. Well, they never give anything back. Well, back in the day, redfish, they cut off redfish. You know, bull reds were off limits. Mm-hmm. I caught the state record bull redfish during that prohibition time. I caught a 58-inch redfish, and it was fat, huge. And at the time, the state record, I forgot what the poundage was, but I remember looking at the length, and it was like 53, 54 inches. There was no way that my fish wasn't as heavy as that 52, 53, or 54-inch fish. It was a beast. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was hooked way down in his throat with a little Kelly Wiggler, old Long John. And I put both hands inside that fish's mouth to get that lure out. But they did give us back. You know, they gave us back a tag. And so maybe that's where we're going to end up on the trout thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they take it away for 2 years, let us get a better population going, get things rolling again, and then they give a little bit back. But, you know, that's the argument you always hear whenever Parks and Wildlife lowers something. Oh, they'll never give it back. Well,
I'm guilty of saying that, you know, too. Right to do. I've said those exact words.
I know, I've heard. Yeah, I've heard it from a lot of different people.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this.
They have given back over the years.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I'm all about, like, I think we all three are. I think most people listening to us are, we want to catch more fish. So there are going to be things that you have to do if you're going to be catching more fish. But again, just to put a bow on the croaker discussion, let's go to Nick and the actual how to's. You know, you tell people on your boat, this is what you do. This is how you hook it. This is the type of hook you use. The bite is different. I've been told multiple times, you know, about the bite, you have to let it take it. You have to let it swallow it, which can be a little dicey because if they swallow it, it might go down to their stomach and you have issues. Let's pretend you've got every one of our listeners, Nick, on your boat right now. Your transport, your 26th transport, whatever it is, it has a couple thousand people on it, 5,000 people on it. What are you telling them if they want to do that?
So typically, you know, I use a chatter weight, a little pink shaker weight, made by a guy named Steve Walko, very effective, but I don't just use that with croaker. I'll fish other live bait with it too. Mm-hmm. And I run about an 18-inch leader, I guess. And, I'll typically, depending on the size of the bait, earlier in the season, the croakers are a little smaller. I'll use a 3-aught hook. And then as the season progresses, you get later in the summer, you know, I'll move to a 4-aught or a 5-aught hook. Very seldom do we ever hook them in the throat. Like, right. So initially, a lot of times when, you know, I'll hook them, I guess, let's go back to how I hook the croaker. So I typically hook them back, you know, closer to their anal fin, the last fin on the back portion of their body. And depending on, you know, I typically go above the lateral line, mm-hmm. But sometimes I'll go below the lateral line because it makes the croaker swim up or swim down. It'll make it do some different things, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, typically right before you get a bite, you'll start feeling the bait, get really, really nervous, really, really active because it's about to get eaten and it knows it's about to get eaten. Doesn't always happen, but most of the time it will. And you'll feel a thump. Like they will absolutely, like if you've ever had a really good corky thump, mm-hmm. This is 10 times better, and it's probably the reason that I actually like to throw them. It's a hell of a bite, but after that happens, it's more of a game, and this is another part of it that I like, which makes it not as easy as some people think. Sometimes that fish will swim at you with it, and sometimes he'll just sit there and chew it, and when they initially hit it, they hit it in the head to kill it. Mm-hmm. And my theory is that they run that croaker back and forth in their mouth, kind of descaling it before they
almost like a flounder would hit a bait.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's, you know, you'll get into a lot more aggressive bites where they actually knock the crap out of it and take off and you got them, you know, it's not as hard to understand what's going on, but they can be really, really finicky. And that kind of gets into the part of it where I was talking about not catching the fish for my people. Like I'm not going to do that. And I guess I don't really want to get on this topic too much because I don't want to accuse people of that, but
yeah,
there is some of that going on, mm-hmm. you know? And if I was to book a guide and went out there with them and I caught one or two fish and they caught the rest of them.
That's not right.
And I would be too excited about going back with that guide.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. That's actually happened with me about a couple of decades ago. You mentioned the season before we move on. What is the season?
Typically I've thrown them as early as spring break, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it usually runs into like the first maybe week of October, depending on, you know, temperatures and water temperatures and stuff like that. And I have a really good friend that, like, that's all he does. He does not care to fish any other way. he loves it and he's really, really good at it. And he actually has tanks in his garage and he'll keep them and throw them through the winter. Like just going for one bite, you know, you're not going to be as successful and you're not going to catch near as many fish a lot of days, but he just goes out there just to get that one bite. Even if it's a little one, like, mm-hmm. It's just the way he likes to fish.
So, Scott, again, just putting a bow on this, we've talked about the pros and the cons. This is my thought on the whole thing. If you are a guy that likes to throw a croaker, I would suggest all the things we just talked about, which is, you know, don't catch as many, you know, don't throw as many, don't buy as many croaker, and be reasonable with it. Let the bigger ones go. Here's the other thing that I wanted to ask you about. Mix in the artificials, because, you know, with croaker, this is something that I feel pretty strongly about. Croaker can find fish probably a lot easier, just like live shrimp, but especially croaker can find fish a lot easier. Once you find the fish, Scott, go artificial. You know they're there. You know what I mean? And that might be a good way to kind of transition and also help the croaker population.
Yeah, I've always told people, you know, the best time to try out lure fishing is when you know there's fish there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're already catching fish, now's the time to give it a shot. Yeah. You've got your fish in the box. Yeah. If that's what you went for, you know, to get your five fish, you got them in the box. Now try something a little different. You know, give it a shot. And you might be surprised. You might really like it.
Yeah, yeah, no question about it. All right, so let's get to some other topics that we got. Here's the question. It's about ever-shifting winds, which Scott always is on top of this before I am, and maybe you can help us with the forecast, you know, and we'll get to it later when what would Scott do. But the question is, I'm planning on taking my wife down to Indianola, do some kayak fishing. Looks like there's going to be a big wind shift on Thursday, and then again, another one Saturday evening. What strategy should I employ when there are dramatic wind shifts like they're supposed to be? And frankly, Scott, I'm going to start with you. I've seen shifts Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You get almost four different directions. What do you do in that case?
Well, I've seen it one day.
Yeah, exactly.
It swings all the way around. Mm-hmm. And it all depends on how strong it is, what the water quality looks like. You know, I'll fish a windy shoreline, you know, in a heartbeat, if the water's still decent. Now, you get into that chocolate, you know, it's been sustained and blowing hard on that shoreline, that's roughing it up pretty bad. Being a lure fisherman, it makes it really tough. We would do it during tournaments, you know, always did it in tournaments. That's where the bigger fish generally were staying.
Yeah.
You know, windblown cove, you know, wind blowing straight into a cove. I don't care how dirty it was, put a popping cork and a gulp underneath it and we could win a tournament. Mm-hmm. For fun fishing and what I like to do with poling and sight casting, I'm always going to go to the calmer shoreline.
Oh, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, typically I'll look for cleaner water. You know, if I could find protected areas that wind's not going to affect really at all, you know, maybe smaller lakes, smaller ponds. And it's, you know, like Scott said, you know, I look for bait, windblown shorelines, you know, if it's swirling, it's changing back and forth, you're not really going to have that,
mm-hmm.
but you know, these fish are going to, they're going to stay with the bait.
Right.
It's a little bit harder whenever, you know, all the water's dirty because the bait will be a lot more spread out, you know, mm-hmm. I think that's why color changes work so well.
You know me and color changes. And streaks. I'm a big a fan of that. But what about that? You know, do you tend to, you don't want to run your boat all day, Nick. You know, you don't want to be just driving your boat all day, but you do want to find either that good streak, the tide line, because the wind, you know, sometimes there's wind streaks, but you also want to find the better water. Do you have a particular, like, just section of the bay you feel strongly about because you know the bay, or do you just, you know, how do you judge that?
I think that's more of an advantage of time on the water. We know what the fish have been doing and where we've been catching them and areas that they've been. And, you know, really just like years on the water. Like I already know, you know, where I'm fixing to be catching fish. I already know. And and I'm excited about it because, you know, it's cold weather. we're already throwing corkies.
So. We're already throwing corkies. Yeah, we might get that in a future, podcast. So Scott, you know, you didn't quite get to finish your point. We lost your microphone there for a second. So what were you saying about to wrap up the wind, you know, the ever shifting winds?
And like Nick was saying, we have a big advantage by being on the water every day and knowing where the fish were to begin with. Mm-hmm. So when that wind shifts, if we know that there was some fish on, say, the north shoreline, we got this strong south wind blowing, we know those fish are probably still going to be in that area. And we'll stick it out a little bit longer and pound on them a little bit harder and work it harder because you have the confidence to know that they were already there. The weekend guy, you know, just showing up, man, that dirty water does not look good. You know, it's harder fishing. There's no doubt about it. You know, especially if you're throwing lures, you're just going to have a harder time getting that bite because you got to get it right in front of their face.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of casts that get seen by a fish goes way down in that dirty water. So it's harder to say that for the weekend guy going out there. He hasn't been on fish all week and doesn't have the intel that we've got. So for them, I'd say probably go ahead and go to the calmer side and where you can spot bait better. You can see the bait better. You can see the fish better.
You know, this was something that we talked about last week, but I want to get Nick's thoughts on it because you reminded me a lot of times, you know, I mentioned, you know, the dirty water, and you mentioned time on the water and experience and all that. We've talked in the past about, you know, bigger baits that make bigger noise or whatever. That to me, it reminded me of something that I'm going to get to with Nick here in a second. But the knock and tail, the one that has the rattle in it, is another one. Every little advantage that you can get, you know, moving, making the noise, getting attention to your bait, you know, the knock and tail with that rattle, you get into a good streak. It might just be a little bit better of an advantage. And what I was going to ask you about, Nick, is we were talking about schools, and right now is, you know, bird season, so to speak. And I know you've been out on the water a lot. You've seen the birds working. And one of the questions that Caleb and Scott talked about last week, and it just reminded me, because I know you'll have some good thoughts on this, is trying to find the better trout among the birds, on the edges or underneath. You know, I wanted to get your thoughts on that because it reminded me of knock and tail, because a lot of times that's what I'll do. I'll throw over with a bait that I don't necessarily have to work as hard, like the knock and tail plastic. So you can get it low and almost just reel it in underneath the smaller trout on the top, and it'll give you a better advantage that way. But what are your thoughts on that? Finding the better fish.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll throw a heavy lead head, you know, like I'll throw a 3/8 lead head this time of year, just try to get down. You know, a lot of those smaller fish will be on top, but the bigger fish will be on top too. You really just get, like, right now, the way it's been, they've either been trout or sand trout. Like, if you hit a group of birds, there's either going to be trout under them or there's going to be sand trout.
That can be fun.
Most of them are sand trout right now. Yeah, I don't mind catching them. Some of them are pretty good size, actually, too.
Yeah.
But really, you just got to bounce around until you find the right group of birds. But they don't really work like they used to where mm-hmm. you could stay on the same group of birds for an hour. Like, some of these birds, they see your boat turn in their direction and they're already busting up.
Yep.
So we've been catching a lot of redfish under birds here lately, too.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. I've been, I mentioned this last week. I've just been looking for birds sitting on the water as much as anything, because they've probably been spooked. They're used to boats. They get a little scurry, so to speak. If I see two or three birds sitting on the water, that's good enough for me, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll stop on groups like that. Maybe if I'm seeing it a bunch, you know, I'll stop on a few and then I'll try to find some working and maybe come back and check those areas if I wasn't successful, because those birds are waiting on something. They're either full and can't eat anymore and they're just staying with the fish, or the fish are full and are staying with the bait, you know, and just not really pushing them to the top yet. So, I mean, it can work both ways. So like you said, a lot of times you can catch fish. Just because they're sitting doesn't mean you're not going to catch the fish underneath them. You know, exactly. They're going to stay with the fish, or at least in the area.
Especially if you can get their attention, put it on their nose, just irritate them, whatever. Yeah. And don't forget, go ahead.
I'll even throw a big topwater underneath birds. The birds, they'll mess with them a little bit sometimes.
They'll dive at them, but they very rarely take them.
Yeah, for the most part, they'll leave them alone, and a lot of times you'll get the better bites with the topwater.
Yeah. So good time, since I mentioned Nocatail, to make sure you get the Bite Me 20 promo code at MyCoastOutdoors.com as well. All our friends, man, they're taking care of our listeners. Bite Me 20, MyCoast Outdoors, you can get those Nocatail 20% discount. Scott, this is right in your wheelhouse. Now, I don't think you've ever put on your business card that you're an expert sheep's head fisherman. Maybe you have. But one of the questions that it's a great fish. Make no doubt about it. It's a great fish. Hey, John, had an idea for the podcast with winter approaching, and that's catching sheep's head. We caught a bunch this past weekend, and the kids loved it. Would love to learn more. Is there a tactic to catch sheephead? Scott, I think you're with me. You like catching sheephead.
Yeah, it's a fun kid trip. Yeah,
absolutely.
Go to the jetties. Any hard structure around pier pilings, jetties, San Luis Pass at the bridge. Those big bridge pilings have got them all up and down there. Think about what they naturally eat. They'll eat barnacles. You know, they'll scrub the barnacles right off of something. That's what those two big teeth up there in the front are for.
Mm-hmm, their smile.
As far as catching them. Yeah, put a shrimp under a popping cork and go at it. Throw it right up against the structure, as tight to it as you can, and you don't have to pop it. Just let it sit. And a lot of times you'll see that shrimp start jumping around, you know, kind of like he was talking about Kroger getting nervous. That shrimp will start jumping around the cork right before it gets eaten. It's also a great fish for fly fishermen. You know, I get guys all the time want to catch a sheep's head on a fly, and it is one of the hardest fish that we've got out there to catch on a fly. I mean, they are a pain in the butt.
They are.
You can throw to hundreds of them and not catch one. And then all of a sudden you'll throw it one and he just stomps all over it. There's really no rhyme or reason. I've got a little bit of a tactic for doing it with the fly that I wouldn't say it's 100%. Nothing's 100% on sheep's head, but the percentages go up. If you find one that's feeding along in the grass, he's just nosing like a redfish. Throw the fly close to him, and they'll almost always dart straight over to it when they see that splash.
Mm-hmm.
They'll stop and they'll stare at it. And if you just leave it there, they're just going to stare at it. Then you wiggle it, and they turn around and they leave the county. I mean, they I don't know what it is about a quarter-inch long, half-inch long fly that freaks them out, but it does.
So what do you do?
You throw it up there, and as soon as he turns and you know that he saw it, he felt it, he just rushes over there to look at it, take it away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Do a back cast, pull it right out of the water. You'll see that sheep's head lose his mind, going crazy, zigzagging back and forth, looking for what just left. Plop it right back into the same spot. You got to be a good caster. You got to have, you know, the right guy on the boat to be able to pull it off. Mm-hmm. But with the right caster, if he can put it right back in that same spot again with the next cast, they'll eat it.
That's interesting.
I'd say probably – it's probably a 30-40% chance that they're going to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
If you lay it right between their eyes, as close to them as you can, and as soon as he sees it again, they'll eat it. It's a lot of fun when they do it.
That might like work fun. With regular soft plastics too. If you're not getting the bite,
it works with the bugs jig. I can mm-hmm. tell you that.
Yeah,
I've had a lot of guys with spinning gear. We do that same tactic. Rip it away from him and then flop it right back in there. As soon as you see him get frantic looking for it, put it right back on him. And what it does, it keeps you from wasting time on that fish, because you can screw around with a sheep's head for 30 minutes sometimes and they won't eat.
Mm-hmm.
This way you get one or two reactions. You either get a bite or he leaves.
Yeah.
And he leaves in a hurry. So game's over one way or the other.
One thing, Nick, and it's been erratic, as Scott just said, nothing's 100%. They have a very unique bite as well. Compare, you know, people always talk about the flounder bite, and we've talked about it on this podcast. Man, it's just a different thing. Now, sometimes they'll just maul it. Every fish will. But the sheephead, what are your thoughts on that when you got kids on the boat or you just want to catch a sheephead?
So most of the time when I actually specifically target a sheephead, it's when I have kids on the boat. But it's usually like right around spring break, we have that. I guess they're spawning. Mm-hmm. You know, they just kind of show up and you can catch them just about anywhere. And I'll pull up to a reef. Typically, I know a few that they normally are always at that time of year, and throw a shrimp or a cork, and usually they hit it pretty immediately. Like they don't play with it. They eat it and go.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually do have another little trick that somebody taught me a long time ago. I actually used it this last summer. We're fishing like a little tournament, and they made a sheephead one of the fish in the tournament. So later in the day, I told them, I was like, I'm not worried about a sheephead. You know, we'll try to catch flounder and redfish and stuff like that. And I don't think trout was actually part of the tournament, but there's a set of pilings that runs across East Matagorda Bay. And so we had finished doing what we were doing. We went to try to catch our sheephead, and all we needed was a legal one, because mm-hmm. I didn't think anybody else was really going to target that fish. And I took my anchor out, and I pulled down next to this pole, and I took my anchor and I raked it along that pole and knocked all the barnacles off of it, or all that I could.
Yeah.
And I moved to the next pole and did the same thing. And then I did the next pole. So I did three of them, and it took about 20 minutes. So after I did that, we went back around to the first pole and set up to where we're throwing just down current of it, you know, or, you know, up current to where it comes down current. So you kind of follow that shell path, or, right. You know, and we caught sheephead, and we moved to the next one, we caught sheephead just about every location.
Oh, wow.
And that's what we did. We kind of knocked that barnacles and stuff off, the stuff that they eat off of those poles. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like chumming for them, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Another thing about sheephead that obviously, you know, Scott just referenced it. This is a fish that is going to be in the same place every time. You know, if you catch sheephead in a particular place, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, you can go back to that place the next year, the next 5 years, and there's probably going to be sheephead there.
Most of the time, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny that you said that, scraping. One of the old rules was we had to carry an oar with us in a boat. That was part of the Parks and Wildlife regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we used to use. We had this big old long 6-foot oar that was a heavy duty. So you couldn't have paddled a boat with that thing to save your life, but it was great for knocking sheep's head off, you know, knocking the barnacles off for sheep's head.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely,
that's how we almost won the CCA Star Tournament one year doing that. We were knocking barnacles off at the San Luis Pass Bridge and popped us, I think it was 9 pounds, 8 ounces.
How'd that not win?
Sheep's head contest. It led it all summer. The way up to the very end. And then at the very end, 2 10-pounders came in and ended up coming in third.
Hey, man.
A lot of sheephead.
That's a lot of the wonders of the wonders of technology. You know, sometimes just a good old oar gets it. Oh, hey, speaking of the wonders of technology, before we move on, because this is going to be a good topic I want to dig into, on the oyster boat pressure. I know both you guys have some thoughts on this, and I think it's a very, very important one. But speaking of technology, you reminded me of a text exchange I had with JT from the Boatyard and Jake Koshy over at the Boatyard in Kima. You guys know that's my place, and I would highly recommend it. I know they got a bunch of motors in, 60s and 115s. They have that JL audio system in and the amplifier, so that's cool. But what he was telling me, Scott, both of you might know on this. Have you heard about this Dakota lithium battery? To me, it could be a game changer. Let me just lay it out here. It's a lithium battery, the Dakota lithium battery. They have it over there at the Boatyard. And it weighs less than 10 pounds. And with that lithium battery, and I've seen some lithium batteries. I'm talking about this one. It versus the 80 pounds of 2 conventional batteries, or you know, they can use them for cranking or deep cycle. To me, you know, you want your boat light. You want to be able to move. Scott, that how much experience do you have with these lithium batteries that are just 10 pounds or less than to have the power of the 2 80-pounders or 40-pounders?
I've got three. They come in 12, 24, 36. Mm-hmm. I've got 312 sitting in the garage waiting on the new boat whenever it gets here. I'm going to start running them this year.
So you haven't quite put them on the water yet?
I've already got the batteries, and I mm-hmm. know a bunch of people have used them. There's been ups and downs with them. The technology was coming along, and I think some people tried it, kind of like braid. You know, people tried braid in the beginning and didn't like it and moved back. Mm-hmm. I think lithium's the future. I think that's the way it's going to go. The biggest drawback that some people don't like about it, and I know Caleb got mad at his, mm-hmm. He's been using some lithium from time to time. When they quit, that's it. There's no slowing down. Yeah. You know, lead batteries, you know, you're out there and you're using your trolling motor, you feel it just starting to die down and slow down a little bit, and you know that you don't have much time left. With a lithium, it's like a light switch. It just turns off. But they do last a lot longer. And the positive on that is they run at 100% that whole time, though.
It's kind of like a drill battery.
With lithium, lithium, you know, you're sitting out there, you're running 100% all the time. Mm-hmm. And with lead, you're running 100% for that first hour, and then after that, you're degrading the entire time. So I'm gonna try it on the tarpon boat because I really want it to work, and I want to be able to. My problem with the tarpon fishing with lead batteries is in the beginning of the day, I can chase tarpon just fine. As the day wears on, it gets harder and harder and harder to stay up on them.
Yeah.
And fishing the jetties, you know, like I do a lot for the tarpon, just trying to stay in that current. And next thing you know, your boat's going backwards and you got it on 10. And it's just the battery's dying down. So I'm really looking forward to trying it out.
Yeah, he was texting me, and I'd heard of them. I hadn't known anyone that had them. Nick, do you have any experience with that or some of your buddies?
No, I don't have any. I mean, I know Caleb runs them. Daniel McCray runs them. I do like Scott's points that he was making. I mean, I never really thought about it that way. I'm a little skeptical of the newer technology, you know, like if it's not broke, don't fix it, kind of the way I always feel like. But I kind of get in the same situation Scott's talking about. Like, I'll start off my battery strong, and, you know, if you're fishing any kind of current, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're going backwards. You know, you can't really do much.
And especially when it's windy and all that stuff. Yeah.
I never really thought about comparing it to, like, a lithium drill battery. You know, mm-hmm. they run and run and run until they don't.
It doesn't. Until it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, great point.
And just 10 pounds as opposed to lugging around those 80 pounds. So anyway, they have those. They just got a bunch of them over at the boatyard and came up if anybody's interested in that. All right, so this is a great topic. We've touched on it here and there. But, Scott, I'm going to start with you. You sent me an incredible article. Let me read the question first from one of our listeners. It was on the Bite Me group page if you want to join that. Hey, John, love the podcast. Listen every week. Thank you. Have y'all thought about discussing oyster harvest along the coast? As often as the topic has come up of trawlers destroying bays for croaker, I feel as if oyster boats are just as bad, if not worse, this season with 13 of the 33 shellfish harvest zones closed on November 1st. So they're closed now. The Middle Coast will receive a lot of harvest pressure in certain zones. They've had some great wins, CCA and Texas Parks and Wildlife, the last couple of years, but that's a lot of pressure. And he goes on with a couple of other points, but I think it's a great point. I fish regularly. I fish regularly in a very oyster heavy area, as does Nick. Scott, you know, this is something that clears the water, works as a filter, works as a place for you know, the habitat and the smallest of bait to grow into. It's a fishery. Is this a big problem right now?
Just in my lifetime, I've watched reefs disappear. Yeah, I mean, big named reefs that used to come up to the surface and, you know, low tide you'd see them, and now they're gone. Mm-hmm. All up and down the coast. I've been all over, and it's sad to see it. And what's happened is there's just the commercial harvest is just so strong in different places. I deal with a lot here around San Antonio Bay. I mean, we got a lot of that. And there's just been unrestricted. I mean, there's limits. There's, you know, there's off limit areas. They have, you know, designated areas, but for the most part, it's a free for all. You know, you can pull up there and look out on the bay and see just dozens of oyster boats at different times. And they're all dragging the same reef, you know, and they're just hammering away at it. Copano's real bad about it. San Antonio Bay, seen it in Galveston, different places. I'm a big advocate of Flatsworthy. I've talked about it in the past. Mm-hmm. And Chuck Neiser, fantastic guy. He helped start CCA. You know, he was involved in the beginnings of that. And now there's an initiative going on among CCA, Parks and Wildlife. Everybody's getting on board with it. That article I sent you, you know, that it's got a whole list of everybody, all the organizations that are getting involved. One of our new commissioners there is Mr. Alpin that owns Bucky's. Mm-hmm. We're all familiar with Bucky's.
Yeah, we are.
And he's on the commission now. And they wrote a letter to him about it. And what they're suggesting makes a lot of sense for sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key word in all of it, is sustainability. They want to designate sanctuary reefs, you know, that are completely off limits
year round
to oystering. Let those reefs grow back up, and those will be your sustainable reefs that continue to produce oysters and repopulate all the bay. You know, they'll repopulate the areas that they are oystering. The problem that comes in is they oyster so far down that there's no substrata left for the baby oysters to grab a hold of mm-hmm. to grow a new oyster. They have to have a hard surface in order to attach. One of the suggestions that they're coming up with is they're calling it a dual track lease, mm-hmm. One for restoration and one for commercial. Commercial guys can have their own lease. It kind of does two things. It allows that the nonprofits, universities are doing studies, parks mm-hmm. and wildlife, to have the restoration leases on these certain reefs where you know that any money you're putting into it, like CCA dumps a ton of money into it.
Yeah.
They know that those reefs are being restored and sustained and they're not going to get raped.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll also have commercial leases. And on the commercial side, it's also a good thing there because the commercial guys know that that's their reef and they're now a farmer. Mm-hmm. You know, they can take care and ownership of that reef and farm it in the right ways. So it is sustainable. That helps all of us.
It's accountability. You
know, instead of,
right. Make them have skin
in the
game.
It's a lot of accountability mm-hmm. to it.
Yeah.
And they get a reward for taking good care of a reef because that reef becomes more productive. It's easier on them. They don't have to search around all over the place for new oysters. They go right back to the same areas, and they know that they've set them up in such a way. And you harvest one area of the reef, and then you harvest another area of the reef, and you move it around. So it's not just this free for all that's been going on. I've read through it, and I've talked to them about it a good bit, and I'm all on board with it. I told Chuck I'm all in, whatever he needs from me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and whatever you need from the Bite Me podcast, tell him to come on here and we'll get him taken care of. Now, Nick, I don't think neither you nor I could do a better job than Scott just did of explaining, you know, what's going on and some of the issues and how it can be fixed. But I want to get your thoughts on this because where you and I fish, it's all about the oyster reefs. I mean, we're looking for them. We want them. We want to be able to use them. They help our fishery tremendous, but what are your thoughts just overall on that?
So that's kind of what I wanted to touch on. Like, I don't know that a lot of the listeners, you know, they might not know exactly what the oysters do for our bay system.
Go for
it. You know, they offer shelter for bait fish. They're a very good filter in our bay, and they might've had something to do with our decline in our grass in East Matagorda Bay, the lack of oyster reefs and oysters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they're not filtering the water like they were. I know there was a science fair project. I saw it online. I was researching science fair projects, trying to help my kids 1 year for the science fair. And this kid had done the science fair project of oysters in an aquarium versus no oysters in an aquarium and put water and circulated the water in the aquarium somehow. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the water in the aquarium with the oysters ended up being crystal clear.
Yeah.
Where the water that didn't have any oysters in it stayed dirty and muddy and nasty. So, I mean, it's a very big part of our ecosystem. It gives back so much more than I think I even know.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like the trout, you know, just like the trout population. Like, we've got to take care of our resources and just make sure we leave some, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Back. It's all renewable.
It's everything for me on our Bay system. And you mentioned the grass, Scott. I want to get your thoughts on that, because the oysters, as we both said, Nick and I both said, the filtering process alone gets you better water, but it does a lot more than that in terms of nutrients that fly off of it and yeah. protecting the grass to be able to grow, correct?
Right. Well, part of the grass growing is the filtering of the water. So you've got more light penetration into the water. So naturally you have more grass. East Matagorda Bay used to be covered up in grass. There was mm-hmm. a lot of it mm-hmm. back
everywhere.
In the day. Same with Galveston. If you look at historical stuff on Galveston, there were reefs there like Karankawa. That's why it got the name Karankawa Reef. That's where the Karankawa Indians accessed Galveston Island. They walked across that reef. There was another one that I read about from, believe it or not, April Fool Point over to Smith Point in, you know, over there on Trinity side.
Yeah.
They used to run wagons and pull wagons with mules across Galveston Bay there. Before the ship channel, of course,
mm-hmm.
but there was a reef that was there that on low tide, they could actually cross the bay on that reef all the way across. And that's a long ways, man. If you ever look at it, it's quite a ways across it. And that was all oysters. And historically Galveston Bay had clear water, lots of grass, all that was there, just like it is down further down the coast. So, man, it's got to make a difference. Just imagine if we had that much filtration going on in Galveston Bay now, it wouldn't be so muddy. It wouldn't be so, you know, such a dark looking place. I think it'd be really cool if we can, you know, reproduce some of what nature had back in the day.
Well, I'll tell you a story.
I don't know that we'll ever get that far, but
I know you both probably have done redfish tournaments out of Sabine. I had my trailer down on Pleasure Island for about 5 years. And you may know this, but some of our listeners may not. Pleasure Island got its name because, you know, the island used to run all the way north towards Stutes, and there, to the point where, you know, cars would drive out there, and there was a Ferris wheel, like a little, almost like a, you know, amusement park type thing, all the way out to the middle of where Stutes Island is now. There was a reef there that was oyster and grass, and people, you know, always often say, well, a hurricane blew it out. A hurricane didn't blow out that whole island. You know, it was big, big. And our listeners in Sabina know exactly where I'm talking about. That was, you know, oyster erosion and then the island erosion. And now there's a dirt road that runs up there. But that's one of those things. And the reason I knew we would have a good discussion on this and I wanted to do it is, you know, it goes back to our main, you know, priority here, Nick. We want people to catch more fish, and those types of things are going to get us there. And I know you've seen some things in your years growing up with your dad and going out on his boat of, you know, there might be a better fish population if we leave everything else the same and just fix the oyster problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially.
Yeah. Cause then everything trickles down from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's got to start somewhere. We just have to be good stewards, you know, like mm-hmm. it's a resource that we all love very much. Like mm-hmm. whether you like throwing croaker, you don't like throwing croaker.
Doesn't matter.
Like I grew up an artificial guy. Like as a kid, up until I was probably in my mid 20s, maybe mm-hmm. I never would throw live bait. I just didn't do it. Like, and don't ask me what changed or why I changed. I don't know either. And I'm not, you know, I'm still a real big time artificial guy. Like
oh, yeah.
I went out Saturday and that's, you know, all we throw and I throw them a lot too, but I will go to a live bait if that's what it takes or that's, you know, what my customers want, you know, mm-hmm. But it just all comes back to being a good steward and only taking what you really need to take. You know, the law says you can keep five trout. You're not breaking the law. But if you keep those five trout to take a picture of them on the table and then give them to your neighbor or the guy cleaning the fish at the harbor, then that's a problem. You know, like, just be responsible and
your dad,
take
your
care
dad
of
is,
what you love.
Yeah, your dad is one of the reasons my boat, I'm on the highly touted four now. but your dad is one of the biggest, your dad and Tommy, your uncle Tommy Gardner, Pat's dad. You know, I started throwing artificials with them, you know, so long ago. The old touts that Scott and I have talked about, I got so many of them when I got my first boat. I just started dumping them into the boat, and I had so many. I said, well, there's the name of the boat. It's highly touted. I mean, it's very highly touted. So, yeah, I'm a big artificial guy. One more thing. We're getting a little long here, and I apologize. We'd like to keep it at an hour, but this was a great discussion before we get to what would Scott do. And what would Nick do in this case? When are you going to start wading again, seriously? Because right now in November, Nick, and I know you're a big wade fisherman, but right now in November, it's more or less you can do a lot of the fishing we like to do out of the boat.
We're already wading. The bird fishing has been, it's been good, but you've had to really, really, really move around to catch the fish we want to catch. I've been fortunate enough, I guess I could say, to have fishermen here lately that want to get out of the boat and wade fish. And we've had some pretty good days. I've actually been getting some Snapchats from Pat today. Mm-hmm. I think he struggled a little bit yesterday, but he's caught some really, really good fish today.
I can guarantee you Caleb did too. Yeah. That's why he said, hey guys, I don't know if I can make this podcast. We know why. We know why. And just to reiterate, another one of the Bite Me 20 promo codes, I mentioned wade fishing, coastalfishinggear.com. You know, we talk about, I've mentioned every week, you know, because I like to take care of our guys, about the Wade Wright, the Bite Me combo, which you can use Bite Me 20 as a combo. I haven't mentioned this. There's a really good instructional video at coastalfishinggear.com on how to wear it, what to use, how to do it. It helped me, and now I just strap that thing on every chance I get, and you guys know everything that comes with it. It's a really cool deal with, you know, obviously the Wade Wright belt, Madre sling, front rod tube, large tackle box, shoulder strap, the whole nine yards for 20%. Off. All right, boys, let's get to it. What would Scott do? I'm going to be out there probably Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Nick. So I'm going to ask you second, and I might be taking some literal notes here because I haven't been out but one day last week. Scott, what would you do this weekend? Look at the conditions. You're always on top of it. What are you seeing?
Oh, man. We talked about shifting winds.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was talking about.
We got it coming.
Yeah.
If you can get out on the weekday, there might be a chance for a little bit of a drain on Thursday. Mm-hmm. This front's going to blow in right at daylight on Thursday. And it's strong, 25, 30 mile an hour north, northeast. If it swings a little more north, northwest, we're going to have some falling water. Mm-hmm. And that would be my time. I'd take a shot at that. Now, if it's more northeast, it's not going to knock that water out. We're sitting anywhere. I looked up and down the coast, anywhere from a half a foot to a foot above normal tide right now with all this southeast wind blowing. It's ripping out there right now.
Yeah.
So I'd try to fish that drain deal on Thursday if I could. But if, you know, like you, come Friday, it's still going to be blowing northeast, but then it switches east, and then it switches southeast by Sunday.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to play that wind and see if you can find some clean water. Maybe some dirty streaks will pop up because of this. Fish those streaks. Look for some birds, especially if we have that, you know, any kind of a drain day on Thursday. The birds should be working Friday and Saturday. If I were betting man, I'd say that's a good possibility. Mm-hmm. The redfish, they're going to hang out in those back lakes. I don't think it's going to be enough of a drain to pull them out. So I would still work the back lakes, work the edges of the bay, and should do all right. Everything's schooled up right now. So it's the best time of year.
It is.
It's one of the easiest times of year to fish.
Nick, one of my big strategies, I'm going to get one of my sons out there on Saturday and correct me if I'm wrong. I said, we may not want to get out there too early. We might get out there about 10 and fish all the way to dark. There's going to be a major in the afternoon, and I think the wind might settle down a little bit. Am I wrong on that? What would Nick do?
I know just to go out there and have fun and get a bite. Like the last hour of daylight, hour and a half, has been really, really good here lately. Friday, I'm going fun fishing for myself. I got a group of guys. We're all going, and we're specifically chasing that one big bite like idiots, you know, just going for one fish all day. Just try to catch one fish. Hopefully,
hey, man, I've been there.
A little better bite than that. Saturday, I have a trip, so I'll be in the boat. And I agree with Scott. I think the birds will probably start working again. We've been catching a lot of redfish. Redfish really saved us throughout this whole freeze ordeal. Gave us another fish to kind of target. I'm sorry for the redfish guys. They've kind of taken the brunt of that. But it really forced me to have to do different things. Like, I've always been more of a trout person. I've always liked to catch trout more. It's just the fish I like to catch and like to target. But it's made me a better all-around fisherman. Like, I actually enjoy redfish fishing now. Like, I'll go and chase schools. Like, the schools are starting to work back in the back lake.
You got another one, Scott. Captain.
Yeah, no, like, so me and my wife
convert them one after another.
I'll tell a quick story about last weekend. Me and my wife went out, and we didn't go out till about 10 or 11, something like that. We were fun fishing, chasing birds, and she's like, Nick, she's like, let's go do something different. Like, she wanted to go catch flounder, even though we can't keep them right now, but she likes to catch them. She likes to target them, whatever. And I was like, all right, you know, I had a couple places I wanted to try. And we ended up going back in this lake that I had never been in before, but always kind of wanted to, but didn't really have a reason. And so we go back in this lake, and I start seeing redfish going across this flat. You know, just one here, one there. You know, we're sight casting them, catching them. They're keeper reds. It was such a good time. It's just me and her. So we had this one that swam up to the front of the boat. And she literally put her jig down in 10 inches of water right in front of the fish. The fish swims over, and she caught it. Like, it was amazing. I was like,
that's awesome.
Like, why can't it always be that?
It's not. It's not. Yeah. But it can be.
Yeah, so I don't know if I'm going to fish Sunday yet or not. I got a couple people that want to go. I was actually thinking about maybe taking the day off.
Well, there you go. I'm sure you've heard it. What's your website, man? Get some people who definitely want to go fishing with you. I get asked about it all the time.
Yeah, so I'm on Facebook. You can just search Captain Nick Mosley. I'm on Instagram. I think it's nmosley79, maybe. That might be my Facebook, too. And then my website's www.saltwateraddictionguideservice.com.
There you go,
a little
man.
Long, but
Scott, we've got scottnullphotography.com for all the Bite Me gear. How the pictures coming along? I want to always mention that because they're fantastic, and I know it'd be a great Christmas present as well. She's on it.
She's working on it.
Good deal.
I was informed after last week, you know, when I said we were kind of running low on some stuff, that we were in pretty good stock on most everything.
On the Bite Me stuff?
Yeah, she let me know later that
good. There you go.
Most of the T-shirts were still in stock, and if you're curious about it. You can go on that photography website and take a look at it, and it'll show your sizes. If it's out of stock, we take it off the website, so there's not any back orders or anything like that we have to deal with. So if you're curious if we got your size, get on there and take a look at it.
Good deal. And, of course, you know, shout out to Anglers Anonymous. We're speaking of gas money and Scott Null Photography. .com Anglers Anonymous came on with the Bite Me podcast, and Mike is just a great dude. He actually got to go fishing, which he rarely gets to do. He fished with Caleb last week. So they're out in Katy, really cool place. That's where I get a lot of my stuff. And of course, Freedom Boats, you guys know, I don't need to say it again, but I will. Best boat I've ever had is that Freedom Warrior. I got a funny story. Had a guy text me, actually, you know, just one of our listeners, and he goes, man, I just passed you in the ditch. And I was at in Dallas at my event with my wife had a Camp Gladiator event. I said, yeah, I don't think that was me unless somebody took my boat, but there's another Freedom Warrior. It looks exactly like mine, Nick. So if I see you out on the water, you know, make sure you text, because I will bug you just to see what you're doing. But I got that, what's the actual sky blue, something like that. But there's another one that looks exactly like it. But shout out to them as well. And of course, Chet, Moore, and Pootie. All right, guys, man, this was a fun episode, man. Some really good topics. Absolutely. Nobody got in a fight, even though we might have disagreed on something. So that's always good. It's like they say, you know, no blood, no foul. So that was a good show. Nick, catch them up, man. I know we need to get you back on here as soon as we can. Cap Scott is his wing. He showed me the mobility on his right wing. It seems to be coming along pretty good. So you guys have a great week. Don't forget to do what Scott would do and what Nick would do, because they would never steer you wrong. And if you see me out on the water, come by and say hello. Until then, have a good time, catch them up, and we'll see you next week.